So, excuse me. It's early in the morning. I could do one of two things, and usually what I do, I've done several of these talks at these schools, is combine them. So the first thing is to talk a little bit about what it's like to be a scientist and why I became a scientist and why I still am having fun doing it. And then I'd like to show you one mystery of current interest, which is something that I think everybody here can easily understand, and is one of the prime experimental mysteries of the time. Is this thing in the way? We don't need all this fancy stuff. I will maybe show some slides from my computer later on towards the end. So does that sound okay? Okay. So I do a little bit of autobiography, and then I'll do a little bit of science. So there are a lot of stereotypes and assumptions about why people go into science and things that characterize different scientists, and most of them are not really true. So I can tell you something about my story, which I think is not typical, but then if I look at the people working in this building who are succeeding as scientists, very few of them have what I think one imagines is a typical story. And I'm not even going to speculate what a typical story is. So my story is that I wasn't very interested in physics or science through most of high school. I was interested in literature. I was interested in music. I had a rock and roll band, and that was the focus of my ambitions, mostly. I did have a fortunate experience, which is that my grades were not very good, and I was, as a result, prevented from taking the advanced math track in high school. Or rather, to put it, what they really said is you might be able to take either the advanced English or the advanced math, but not both, and definitely not the advanced track in biology, physics, chemistry, or history, any of those things. And I was unhappy with that, and so I talked to a friend of my parents who was a mathematician working in a small college in the area. And he made a proposal, basically that we show up the educational standards of the school. And he challenged me to take pre-calculus classes in college over that summer. So this was ninth grade. I don't know if that means anything. It means something to Americans. I was 14 at the time, and so he challenged me to go to college over the summer and take the pre-calculus classes, and if I succeeded, he would help me take the calculus, which was the end of the advanced sequence, the last year of high school math, the next year, 3 years early. And I did that, and I liked math. I'm not a mathematician, and I understood, since I knew a couple of mathematicians, I understood pretty well that I wasn't a mathematician. A mathematician is not just somebody who's good at math in school. A mathematician is somebody who can think creatively about ideas structurally. That is, one way to put it is that what you learn in school when you learn math is, you know, here's something that you want to demonstrate or a calculation you want to do, which is like a mountaintop, and you learn a route up the mountain. But a mathematician learns to fly above the mountain and see all the ways you might go up to the top and all the relationships between them. And I'm not. I learned that I wasn't a mathematician very early. But I could fake it really easily. I could learn math quickly and kind of fake it, and because I could have a kind of intuition, which now I understand is the kind of intuition that physicists use, which is sort of rough and ready, very visual, very unrigorous, I've certainly not proved the Sears theorem in my life. Maybe Gödel's theorem, which I studied the proof of once, because the claim is so outrageous, which is that mathematics is incomplete. But that's the only theorem that I ever studied. So anyway,
I succeeded at this challenge. Then I got interested in architecture.
And I got interested in architecture because there was a very, at that time, very influential figure in America who was Buckminster Fuller. Has anybody ever heard of him?
Wow.
What's the name again?
Fuller. How have you all heard of him?
Buckyballs.
Okay. So Buckminster Fuller was somebody who had dropped out of college his first month of college, never got an education, but become an inventor. And he was also one of the early environmentalists. He was one of these people who was incredibly original and in everything. So as an architect and an inventor, he invented these geodesic domes, which are these big dome-like structures where you take a sphere and you construct it out of triangles. And he had also invented a car that got, I don't know, 80 or 100 miles to the gallon or something like that. He had invented ways to organize and make a house that used far less energy. And this is back in the 1940s and 1950s. And he was a very early advocate of seeing the Earth as a whole system, as a whole planet, and trying to develop the economy all over the world by being sparing with the resources, by using them intelligently. And he was a great hero to many people. So he, as it happens, came through where we were living then, which was Cincinnati, Ohio. And through a serendipitous story, which is too long to tell, I ended up inviting him to give a talk where I went to high school and ended up meeting him. So I decided I wanted to be, he was very inspiring, and I decided I wanted to be an architect. Yes?
Is he the one who designed the American Pavilion for the 67?
The Expo 67, yes. Yes, that's him. There was sort of an atmosphere at the time, you know, there were families who thought of themselves as very hip and progressive who were building them and living in them. They're terrible places, actually. It's very hard to live inside a sphere.
They're very weird, yes. It's just there in Montreal. You're walking down the bus.
Well, that's a huge one. Yeah, that one is huge. But there was a whole sort of culture affiliated with them. That most of which has died, with Woodstock and all that. But in any case, he was a great hero. I decided I wanted to be an architect like him. I started playing with lots of designs. And then I had to get a summer job, and I couldn't get a summer job. So I decided that I would make a little company and sell swimming pool covers, which I could make from geodesic domes. Now, luckily, nobody ever actually bought one of these domes. I would get invited over to make a proposal to somebody's house, and then I would send them a design, and then I would never hear from them again, which is good, because I had no idea how to make one. But what I got interested in order to make them, I realized I didn't need a sphere. I needed a sort of, spheroidal shape, an oblong spherical shape. And that had to be made out of triangles, too. And to figure out how to do that, I needed more math. And so I went to the people I knew who were mathematicians, and I said, what do I need to know to understand forces and triangles on curved surfaces? And they said, you need differential geometry or tensor calculus. And it happened that I went to the library and I got those books, and they were way advanced for me. This was sort of 11th grade, but I could learn the stuff. And I had a lot of fun learning it. And then I found that at the end of every such book, there was a chapter on general relativity theory. So I started to read about general relativity theory, because the same mathematics that you would use to discuss forces on curved surfaces in a building is the same mathematics that Einstein had used to discuss curved space-time in his theory of general relativity. So I got some more books, and I started to learn general relativity, which I thought was pretty cool. I should say I didn't know any physics at all. I had flunked ninth grade physics, and I had been prevented from taking any further physics. I didn't know anything, but it didn't seem to matter. I could learn general relativity in the physical picture. And I think completely randomly, I lucked out in that what was available in the library were actually original sources, like a book of Einstein's early papers, which I could just study, and which anybody can study. It's actually simpler than many of the textbooks, which are written in a more sophisticated level. So I was learning general relativity. Then one day, I decided to find out who this Einstein guy was. Of course, we'd all heard of him. And I found a book of essays about him, which had a kind of autobiography by him in it. And I read that one night. I was supposed to go on a date with somebody I'd been asking out for a long time, but she stood me up. So I just read that. And I got this idea. I mean, he talked about how the world is human existence is short, and this is sort of the Hobbesian thing, short and brutish, and by the very existence of a stomach, we're condemned to trace, you know, to get a profession and chase money and material goods and so forth. But beyond that, there's this great, beautiful world of nature, which has nothing to do with human beings, but human beings can comprehend. Einstein was a great believer that we could comprehend the laws of nature. And he set this up as a very lofty goal, as a kind of beautiful, transcendent thing to do, to devote one's life to discovering the laws of nature, which were things that were beautiful but beyond human. And that appealed to me enormously, especially in my current state of mind there,
having been stood up. And I also somehow, I had this sense as I read how Einstein, he wrote this towards the end of his life, in about 1949, 1950. I had this sense that I could understand what he was worried about. He was worried about quantum mechanics, which didn't make any sense to him, even though he was the first person who had realized there had to be a new theory, and he was the first person who had realized that photons were both waves and particles. He had never been able to make any sense out of quantum phenomena, and he spent his whole life not believing in quantum mechanics. And so if you have trouble when they explain quantum mechanics to you, remember, really smart people don't believe it, by the way. They believe it works experimentally, it gives good predictions, but they don't believe it's a theory of nature. And Einstein didn't. So I got that right away. And then I got that there was this problem of connecting the quantum world to space and time and gravity, which is what we call the problem of quantum gravity. So I don't know, I mean, you're the age that I was then, so maybe you can relate to this. Now it seems bizarre. I just said to myself, oh, I can do that. And that's what I've done. So my life actually has been very simple from that point on. There were a few problems, like by then I dropped out of high school and I had to figure out how to get myself from there to here. But I did manage to talk myself into a college despite the fact that I dropped out of high school. I can't believe I did that either, because they rejected me twice, and I insisted.
What college? I'm just curious.
Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts.
And then?
What?
And then?
Then I had, now it's often said, now it's good that you're raising it, you're probably one of the teachers, and I'm going to, right?
No, I'm just too.
because it's often said, and I think it's really true, that it's very important for somebody to become a scientist to have along the way at least one really good teacher who mentors them. And I was lucky enough to have two. One of them was this friend of my family, this mathematician who had gotten me into math early, and the other was somebody called Herb Bernstein, who was teaching at physics at Hampshire College, and who became my teacher. And the fact that I'm here, that I actually managed to do something in science, is entirely due to the two of them, especially since I had a rather bad character to start with. I certainly never would have vanished on my own. So anyway, so from then on, I had a good teacher in college. I went to graduate school, and somehow I managed to succeed to do a little science. The rest of it, since it's a long time in your future, I'm not going to talk about unless you ask me. I think just I wanted to give that introduction to give you an idea that there are people who manage to do science who start off without, for example, the benefits that you all have of good teachers, of probably having had physics in high school and being here. Okay. Shall I tell you a little bit about a science problem, a real science problem?
Yeah.
Okay. This is not homework. This is the real thing. Okay. This is about galaxies. And here's the problem. The problem is, how do you determine what's the matter in a galaxy? What's the mass in a galaxy? And I'm going to be interested in a particular kind of galaxy, which is a disk galaxy. Can somebody tell me basically what a disk galaxy is composed of?
A disk.
A disk, yeah. What's in the disk?
Stars.
Stars, good. Gas. What else? Gas. That's actually advanced. I didn't know that till a few years ago. So here's a top view. There is a sort of region in the middle, and then there's a disk, and there are stars that go around in almost circular orbits. From front on, the disk looks like this. There's a sort of bulge here of stars. These stars are sort of moving around randomly in the spherical distribution. They turn out to be much older than the stars in the disk, which is interesting. A thing you may not know about disks, disk galaxies, which I'm not going to use today, is that, you know, they have these sort of spiral arms. I'm a very bad drawer. Not all. I have a few friends who really are great drawers. Roger Penrose has even had an exhibit of his drawings that is from illustrating his calculations in an art gallery in London. But most of us are terrible. So it turns out that in at least some galaxies, the arms, does anybody know what's going on in the arms? Okay. What's going on in the arms is that there are clouds of gas and dust which are very cold and very dense, and that's where new stars are being formed. And a typical disk galaxy is continually making new stars at the rate of roughly one star per year. Okay, so it's not a dead object. It's not just a bunch of stars sitting there. There's a process going on where stars are getting made all the time out of gas and dust. That's not the part I'm going to tell you about now, although there are lots of mysteries connected to that. What I'm going to tell you about is, how do you determine the distribution of mass in the stars? Does anybody know? Yeah?
If you know the radius of the galaxy and the velocity and the outer of the star, then you can determine the mass because the gravitational
acceleration. Okay, good. Good. So there are two ways, and this is one way. And let's review this. Okay. If you have a circular orbit, there's a relationship between velocity and radius and acceleration, which you may have learned. Does anybody know what it is? Yeah. The acceleration is towards the center, and its magnitude is v squared over r. So if you can measure the radius, r, and the speed, you can measure the acceleration. If you know how far away the galaxy is, you can, of course, how do you really do this? You see an image of a galaxy in a telescope. Okay, you know the angular size on the sky,
Okay, and you need to know the distance to get the radius. So how do you know the distance?
Yeah.
Redshift. Yeah. You look for lines of hydrogen or something you can recognize in the light from the galaxy. Okay, and from the redshift you get the distance to the galaxy. From the distance and the angular size on the sky, you get the radius. How do you get the velocity of the star? Yeah?
Can that be the relative redshift of the outer?
Same way, exactly. That's right. Relative redshift, redshift of stuff over here. Imagine that that it's sort of oriented like this to you. So it sort of looks like this, and the stuff is here is going around like that. Then this stuff is coming towards you, this stuff is going away from you, therefore this is bluer and this is redder. Okay, and I'll come back later to exactly how it's done, because that's part of the story I want to tell. Okay? So then you get the acceleration. And this gentleman said, from the acceleration times the mass of the star is the sum of all the other stars of the Newtonian force from it. So g times the mass of that star, the mass of the other stars, over the distance squared, and there's some vector stuff. This is the distance to the other star. Okay? But, so that's Newton's law, that there's a force proportional to the masses, Newton's constant, and 1 over the distance squared. Okay, I assume everybody knows that. Okay? But there's a nice trick you can use that actually Newton first demonstrated in his book, The Principia, where he published all this stuff in 1687, which is that you can take all the mass within the radius of the orbit as if it's just at the center. So there's a mass m of r is the mass inside the orbit. And then this is just the mass of the star, the mass inside the orbit, over r squared times g. And you don't have to do any more adding up. You just have to know all the mass inside the orbit. And this is the radius of the orbit again. OK? There's only one mistake. I make lots of mistakes, and you're supposed to catch them. What? If there's a vector, it points to the center, and therefore there's a minus sign. Okay. So that's one way you can measure the distribution of mass in a galaxy. There's another way. Does anybody know what the other way is? Well, it's obvious. And so look, science is about seeing the obvious when it's right in front of you. And this is an example, yeah?
Maybe the density?
The density of what, exactly?
The whole galaxy.
Yeah?
I don't know.
How do you get the density of the whole galaxy?
Just look at how much light is coming from it.
Exactly, yeah. You see, you can measure an amount of light, an amount of energy in light, okay? And then from knowledge of stars and gas and dust, and this is actually not that simple, because the light comes from stars. Stars are different colors. Different color stars are different masses. And the light also comes from gas and dust. For example, a lot of infrared light comes from gas and dust. Okay. So what you do is you observe in various different bands of different colors, and astronomers know how to convert the light seen in different colors to an estimate of how much mass there is. Okay? So you can just measure the mass, again, within some radius. You can measure the mass within some radius by adding up all the light and using your knowledge of what's going on there, what's giving off the light, to convert to how many stars, how much gas, how much dust. Okay, now, when you do that, you reached a, here's roughly what the distribution looks like. So this is the radius going out this way. This is the amount of mass or density. Let me just graph density after the conversion. Does anybody know roughly what's the radius, a typical distance in a galaxy? Okay, I get 20 light years, 100 light years, 1,000 light years. 50,000, it's thousands of light years. Thousands of light years. Yeah, tens of thousands of light years. Okay? So a typical thing, this might be 10,000 light years, 20,000 light years, 30,000 light years, etc. Okay? And the distribution typically looks like this. There's a big bulge for the bulge in the center. And then it falls off fast. There's a little bit left over because actually it doesn't fall to zero. But almost all the luminosity is in the center, is towards the center of the galaxy. Actually, the stars you see are embedded in bigger disks of gas, of hydrogen gas, which are about 10 times bigger. And they have a little bit of mass too. But most of the mass and most of the density is in the center. Okay? Now, from that we can make a prediction. Because supposing that you're outside, I like drawing pictures, so I'm going to, even though I'm bad at it, so I'm going to draw another picture. Okay? Supposing that you're outside this region where most of so the disk has gotten very thin. There's not much mass out here. Okay. There's some radius here within which most of the mass is, and you're way out here. Okay. Okay. How should your velocity be changing? Okay. We have enough information to work that out. Okay. And shall I just do it for you, or do you want to guess? Please. Should increase?
Decrease.
Let's look at it, okay? Velocity squared. Can everybody see? From here, velocity squared is A times R. That's why you're thinking it's increasing, right? Okay. But A is decreasing. Okay. And if you're outside all the mass, okay, then here's what happens. The mass of the star cancels out. Right, that's a basic feature of gravity, that the velocity of the star, the motion of the star, doesn't depend on its own mass. Because the force is the mass times the acceleration, but the gravitational force is proportional to the mass. So the mass of the star cancels out, which is very good. That means that you're really, by the way, when you're measuring acceleration, you're really just measuring m, the mass distribution. If you're outside all the mass, then this is a constant. The amount of, once you get outside of all the mass, the amount of mass within your orbit is a constant. So the acceleration, so outside all the mass, the acceleration is going like g all the mass over r squared. Okay? So let's put that in. That's g all the mass r squared over r. So it's over R, like that. Okay, do you agree? Okay. So therefore, you get a prediction that the velocity goes like the square root of GM over R. Once you're outside the mass. Any question about that? I want everybody to understand that. It's a consequence of observation. Okay. The acceleration is due to gravity. It's gravity that's keeping in a circular orbit. Gravity is due to mass. Mass gives off light. From the light, you can see where the mass is. When you're outside the mass, these laws should hold. This is just Newton's laws. Okay, and the velocity as you go away in R should fall like 1 over square root of R. If you graph it, now here's R, here's the velocity. What do you expect? Well, you expect it to increase at the beginning because you're in this region here where the more you go out, the more mass there is. You expect it to reach some peak and then to fall off like V goes like 1 over square root of R. Okay, that's the prediction. Okay, and I want to make sure everybody understands the prediction.
So, if you start off in the center, your velocity would increase until it gets to a peak and then decrease?
Yes. The peak is when you have almost all the mass inside your radius.
Wouldn't that be in the center?
No, because this is what the distribution of mass looks like. So it's somewhere sort of here, when you've got most of the mass inside your radius.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's density, isn't it?
Yeah, but density, you just add the mass. So if you add it up, the mass inside your radius goes like this, and then becomes constant.
But it would go kind of like that, because density is not constant, right?
It's not quite, yeah, it increases very slowly. So the mass, to a good approximation, once you're here, all the mass is inside your radius. And to that approximation, if I'm graphing the mass inside of the radius R, it's constant. Once you get outside all the
stuff. No, I was asking about the first part of the graph, but I guess you know, density is dropping.
Yeah, but still it's increasing. Yeah. Okay. I actually don't care about the inside. Okay, the inside is complicated and messy. I just want to highlight this prediction. I want to make sure everybody understands it. That if you go far enough out in a galaxy, and so you get outside of most of the matter, from that point on, the velocity of the stars in circular orbit should fall like 1 over the square root of R. Okay, does everybody get that? Okay. Now, let me tell you a story. Okay. This is a story of a then young astronomer called Vera Rubin in the 1960s, 1970s. Okay. When Vera was a young faculty member, she was measuring the velocities of stars in the region of our star in the solar system. Yeah, sorry, in the galaxy. Okay. And how did she do that? So we're sitting somewhere out, somewhere like that. Okay. And we can measure directly, you may not be aware of that, but we can measure directly the velocity of stars that are close enough to us. How do you do that? You take a photograph, you take a picture of where they are on the sky, and you look at a photographic plate from 50 years ago. And the stars which are close to us have moved. And the great observatories of the world, they have photographic plates from 50, 100, actually, I don't know how old, at least 100 years back. And by looking at the old photographic plates and recent pictures, of course, the recent ones are not photographic plates. They're done by CCD devices directly into computers. But when you compare the old and the new images, you can see that some nearby stars have moved. And if you assume they're going in circular orbits and you see where they are in the sky, you can get a velocity, because you can get an angle that they're moving with respect to us. So you can get a velocity. Yes?
Are those stars like, are they in our galaxy?
In our galaxy. These are stars, I don't know exactly the figure, within on the order of 100 light years. Maybe a few more. Yeah?
But isn't the solar system moving as well? So
yes.
If it's still close enough, wouldn't they be relatively moving around the same pace?
Right. But you would expect from this prediction. So what they're expected to see, here is us. This is radius.
here is zero relative velocity, here is positive relative velocity, here is negative relative velocity relative to us. Okay? And she expected to see data that looked like a 1 over square root of radius curve. She expected to see data that looked like that from the prediction.
Okay. And radius is the distance from the center of our balance.
Yes. Yes. Okay. It's not what she saw. What she saw was that. Flat. Okay? So I told you about a real prediction, and I told you about the data. Okay. And that's been done many times since. So she published that. People said, come on, you didn't do it carefully enough. You're underestimating the size of your errors. Can't be right. We actually had, when Perimeter opened, we had a day of talks, and we had her here, actually I'm remembering, in this room, and she gave a talk about the story just here in this room. I think it's available online. So basically nobody believed it. So then she and a friend invented another technique to look at other galaxies. And this is, I'm not an experimentalist, but this is so elegant, I want you to appreciate the elegance of this experimental technique. Okay. So here's some distant galaxy, okay, light's coming from it. Okay. I'm just going to diagram. What she did is you look at it through a telescope. Okay. And in a telescope, you know, you have some image like this. This is a galaxy of the kind I was saying, sort of tilted towards us. So this is what the image looks like in a telescope. Okay. Now, then she put a slit. You can do all kinds of things inside telescopes. She put a slit like that. So you get a sort of plane of light coming through the slit. Okay? Just light from the galaxy. And she took that sheet of light and put it through a prism and then to a photographic plate. Okay? Now, do I have some colored chalk here? Let's see if I have some colored chalk. Just green. Green is not good enough. But let me show you what it looks like. Okay. So then you look at a line. Okay. So here is the photographic plate. Okay. You look at a line, you focus on a spectral line. Okay. Here is the center of the galaxy. So it's at, now, blue shift is that way, and red shift is this way. Okay. So it's at some particular frequency, okay, that is shifted to because, as somebody said before, the galaxy is moving away. There's the image of the galaxy sort of behind it here. Maybe you can see on the plate. Now, on this side, let's say, it's moving towards us. So you would expect that sheet of light goes up as it's blue shifted more because the velocity is more, and then comes down with that old 1 over square root of radius curve. And on the other side, it should do the same to the red because here it's moving away from us. This is where it's moving away from us the fastest. This is where it's moving towards us the fastest. This should be 1 over square root of r here. This should be 1 over square root of r here. Okay, that's the theory. Yeah. So this is why I'm looking for another color, but I'm not finding it. Okay, so I'll do it. The observation looks like that. And that's been done on hundreds of galaxies. It's always flat, more or less. I'll show you some real ones in a few minutes. Okay. I'm terrible for it doesn't often curve actually up like that. Sorry. It sort of goes flat. Okay. Okay, now I'll show you some real data in a little while, but any reactions? I mean, I explained the theory. Theory was really simple, led to a prediction. What's happening is that the two ways of measuring the mass are disagreeing. One by looking at where the light's coming from, and one by measuring the acceleration directly from v squared over r. Yes?
It's almost like what do you expect there to be, no one is doing that, but there is actually still mass there. So there's no mass. Even when you move outside,
it's mass
considered to be the mass, but there is still more mass.
Okay, so that's one story. That's one explanation. We're now theorists, right? So you're making a hypothesis, right? Hypothesis. Hypothesis one, okay? And I don't know if you've had to sit through these ridiculous things about how science works. You know, science doesn't actually really work the way that they teach you, but it is true that if you're a good scientist, you make hypotheses and you try to test them. That much is true. So that's a hypothesis, okay? There is more mass, and it gives off no light. Right? So I heard somebody say that. No light. Okay, that's hypothesis one. Dark matter is what this hypothesis is called. Okay? Does anybody know how much dark matter is required for that hypothesis? You might have heard about this. What?
5 or 6 times more than this.
Yeah, there are different figures, and you shouldn't confuse this with what's called dark energy. You need between, for a given galaxy, you need 5 to 10 times more than visible. Okay? So this is not a small mistake. Okay? If this is right, then it's the majority of matter in galaxies is of that kind. Okay, any questions, comments? Yes?
Is that the only hypothesis?
No. Yeah?
Our observations are wrong?
It's been done by now. So by so many different people, by so many different methods, invisible light, infrared light, radio signals, okay? It's really there. The observations are correct, yes?
Maybe, if the observation is correct, I don't know, but maybe there's some type that we're not seeing. It's one of those, just because we don't, it doesn't have to be dark.
You mean just matter that happens, not intrinsically dark matter, you're saying, but just stuff that's dark?
Well, it doesn't have to be dark, it just could be stuff we're not seeing.
Why would we not see it? Okay, so, no. So, good point, and there are different sub-hypotheses under this, okay? So it could be just like dead stars that are burned out. It could be black holes. It could be really cold gas that gives off no infrared light because it's like at 3 degrees above absolute zero and just is in equilibrium with the thermal microwave background. Okay. Or
It could be exotic new stuff that nobody's ever seen before. Wimps, bliss.
Machos.
Machos are sort of Death Star kind of things. Okay? Now, there's lots of categories of dark matter, and each of them is a long story. Each of them, of course, because this has been going on since the 70s, has led to efforts to detect it more directly. And the short answer, which doesn't mean that it's wrong, is that so far the efforts to detect different kinds of dark matter directly have not detected any. Okay. Which, yeah? It doesn't yet prove the hypothesis wrong, because you can always adjust your theories to make them harder to detect. So for example, supposing you have a particle which only interacts, it shouldn't be charged, because charged particles give off light and interact with light, but it might say just be like a neutrino and have the weak interaction. Now, we have detectors to detect neutrinos, and we can use them to presumably, if there is this dark matter, it's here now. And we can use the neutrino detectors to try to detect them. And it's been done, and they're not seen. So you might imagine that they interact even more weakly than neutrinos. Okay, and then you get involved in a game of, you know, how low can you go? How low can the experiments go, and how weakly can the theory go? Okay. And let me not say more about that yet. Okay, yeah?
Can the invisible matter be called the visible matter, but it's just we cannot detect that part of the visible matter?
Might be, for example, cold gas, as I said. Okay, could be. Now, just to be complete, though, is there another, can anybody think of another hypothesis? Yeah?
It could be that the formula is used for that bit of wrong.
Yes. So it could be someone, there aren't that many formulas in this. Okay, it could be, so let's look at what the formulas are. Okay? Maybe the theory is wrong. Okay? So let's look at that. I just want to list the formulas that we use. Okay? We use mass times acceleration is force. We use force of gravity is Newton's constant times the two masses, m1, m2, over r squared. And we used acceleration is v squared over r. I think that's all we used. What?
We also used the Doppler effect.
Ah, and we used the blue shift. Yeah, we used the Doppler effect. Okay. Okay, does anybody want to propose any of those are wrong?
Yeah.
Yes? Where it comes to subatomic particles, Newtonian physics, those can be explained.
Sure, but these are stars. These are not subatomic particles.
The light.
So then the Doppler shift might be wrong. Okay, if the Doppler shift is wrong, cosmology and astronomy are really in bad shape. Okay? Yeah?
In that approximation, you assume that to be spherical. However, this is not a disk. So I think this approximation is very close. You know?
That's true. You're right. But it's been done correctly with the disk rather than the sphere, and there still is the problem. And the prediction is still that it should have fallen off by 1 over square root of r. So it's not that. Anybody have another proposal? Yeah. Gravity's wrong. Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah, maybe gravity just falls apart at such large distances.
Okay. So supposing that this is wrong. Okay? No. Supposing that for masses large enough, or distances large enough, or something enough, this is wrong. Okay? Then,
can you invent from what's on the board the right formula?
PV is 4R.
Please?
PV, gravitation force is 4R dimension.
Okay, so that's one guess. Does anybody have another guess? Okay, let's try that guess out. Okay, if the force of gravity, I'm going to use approximately for some large distances, went like some constant times the masses, m1, m2, over r, then when we did this thing, the r's would cancel and the v squareds would be constant. Okay, let's actually do that. Then v squared is the acceleration times r, which would then be just constant times the mass inside r. Okay, so that's a guess. That's a guess. Maybe when you get really far away, the force is not falling like 1 over r squared, the force is falling like 1 over r. And then the velocities will go constant. Yes?
But aren't there like other, so, I mean, this can't be the only calculation we have done as far as galaxies. Would that agree with other things?
Good question. Good question. Very good question. When you look at interactions between galaxies, so first of all, you can play a similar game in a cluster of galaxies, and you can reach roughly the same conclusion, that is, that either Newton's laws are wrong or you need extra matter, holding clusters of galaxies together. So that's true. But just keep that in mind for a while. I want to talk about galaxies for a little bit more. Okay? I want to talk about this alternative hypothesis. Okay, so that's hypothesis two. And I want to explore it with you for a minute. So hypothesis two, okay, is the force of gravity goes actually for large distances like the mass times the other mass, m1, m2, over r rather than over r squared, and some other constant here. Okay? Now, it turns out that that idea has been explored, and let me tell you about another piece of data, okay, which helps to explore that. For each galaxy, there's a velocity, which is the velocity when it goes flat. Okay. If we believe this theory, and we know that velocity, we can get this constant, right? If we believe we know the mass, okay, we can get this new constant that's here. Okay. A new constant of nature. So, can we do that? And so, people noticed something. These are two astronomers called Tully and Fisher. And what they noticed, they graphed the velocity outside. So this is, let me call it the velocity when it goes flat, okay, against the luminosity, which is actually what they can measure. Okay, against the light. Okay. And they've done this a whole bunch of times. Now, to be really careful, because to make sure that there's not errors in luminosity from galaxies being different distances, they take advantage of what we were saying, that galaxies tend to cluster in clusters. They look at a particular cluster, which are all about the same distance from us, and they consider the relative luminosity and of inside the cluster versus the velocity when it goes flat. Okay, you understand?
what I'm saying? So they get rid of errors from misestimating the distances. Okay? And they see a relation. And the relation is that the total luminosity goes roughly like the velocity to the fourth power. And that's actually what's been said. Let me fill in that a little bit for you. I'm bad with blackboard, so I'm starting to run out. But can I use the space here?
Yeah. Do you mean velocity is proportional to luminosity?
No, I mean the luminosity is proportional to the
fourth power. Then
your graph is terrible. My graph is terrible.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. I don't want to redraw it. But you're right. Thank you very much. Okay. Supposing that you convert luminosity to matter, okay, then you get also that the matter goes like the velocity to the fourth power. That takes some work. There are a lot of details about how you, as I said, how you convert light in different wavelengths to matter, okay, to mass. But actually, this is an even better relation. So let's examine that relation that the mass goes like the fourth power of the luminosity. I'm sorry, the mass goes like the fourth power of the velocity. So, because we want to tie down exactly how this new law works, okay, and what the new constant of nature is that's measured. Now, they said, look, this is a gravitational effect. So it shouldn't just be the mass, it should be Newton's gravitational constant times the mass. Because the stronger gravity is, the faster the star should go around. Increasing the strength of gravity should be the same effect of increasing the mass. So we should consider that Newton's gravitational constant times the mass goes like the fourth power of the velocity. Okay. Now, supposing you want to convert this to an equation rather than a proportionality, then you need a constant, gm times a new constant I'll call a0, goes like the fourth power of the velocity. And then the astronomers, using these observations, can measure this new constant, a0. Right. Now, first of all, here's a little homework exercise. What are the units of a0? What kind of quantity is it? Does anybody have it yet?
Yeah, I
got it. What is
it? 1/(m^2)^3.
Yeah, but it's simpler than that. Okay, do you want me to just tell you? Okay. A0 is an acceleration. Did somebody get that?
Yeah.
It's meters per second squared. Cool. Okay. So A0 has been measured. I'll tell you what it is. Okay. It's 1.2 times 10 to the minus 8 centimeters per second squared. That's a tiny acceleration. On the order of 100 millionth of a centimeter per second squared. Okay? Yes.
I'm just curious, how does it compare with the accelerations of the stars, say, the outer edges of the galaxy?
Very typical. It's a typical acceleration for stars in the galaxy, as it happens. Yeah?
Is this still a hypothesis, or is this a fact?
From the data, these people measured this constant. They measured that the luminosity, let me go through the reasoning. was shown from the data to scale like the velocity to the fourth. When they converted luminosity to mass, the mass still scaled like the velocity to the fourth. Assuming that you take out Newton's constant, that you put Newton's constant there, this constant is an acceleration. In many different galaxies, they measure m. We know Newton's constant. They measure the velocity, and therefore they measure a0. And the fact that this fits on a curve, which is a to the v to the fourth, means that there's a single value of a0 that accounts for many different galaxies. Okay? So a0 is measured.
Then where did the mass come from?
Luminosity.
Right. So that's assuming that there is no dark matter.
Yes. This is assuming there's no dark matter. We're exploring your alternative hypothesis.
But does this acceleration constant imply any physical reality, or is it just constant?
Good question. Now I want to tell you about a proposal. Okay. I need one more space of blackboard. No, because this, I just can't move, but I think we don't need this anymore. Okay. So somebody in about 1982 put all this together, whose name is Milgram. And Milgram proposed a theory, an alternative, or as he called it, a modification of Newtonian dynamics, which we call ever since then MOND, for modification of Newtonian dynamics. Okay? And here's Milgram's theory. Milgram's theory is the acceleration of a star in a galaxy. Okay? Now, there are two cases. What you do to apply Milgram's theory is you work out from the observed matter distribution what the Newtonian value of the acceleration would be. That is, what Newton would predict. So let me call that a Newtonian. Okay, what Newton would predict is the mass over r squared times Newton's constant, right? Okay. So you calculate a Newton. And if a Newton is greater than this a0, which is this magic value, okay, then a star equals a Newton. And if a Newton, however, Newtonian acceleration is less than a0, then Milgram says, I'll put it down here, that a star is you take the product of the Newtonian acceleration times a0 and take the square root. And in other words, and that gives the 1 over r. So to say it,
can you lift that board up?
I cannot lift this board up, but let me just write this out. Let me just write this case out over here. This case is a star is square root of g m a zero over r. So you use the 1 over r squared until, so if you're looking at a galaxy, there's some, the accelerations are falling off as you go out. If you're, there's some magic radius where the acceleration is a zero. If you're within that, you use Newton's law. If you're outside of that, you use Milgram's law, which is this weird thing in which you take the product of this magic acceleration with a Newton and take the square root. Okay, does that sound completely crazy?
Yeah. Is that just somehow happens to be a value that's pretty common? Or is that actually a value that you can divide that from something else?
Where A zero comes from?
No, like the formula, let me describe it.
Let me tell you something about theory. You invent theory. Okay, this is invented. Now, this part matches this. This is just this in other language. Okay? But his bold theoretical idea is that there's two things going on. Newton is good as long as your acceleration is not too small. And if your acceleration is too small, there's something else going on, which is given by this new formula. Yes?
He basically derived that from Galois, but does he have like a theoretical backbone for it? Like,
No. Neither does anybody else after 25 years or whatever after that, for 24 years. You've heard about a relativistic version of this.
Yeah.
Let me come to that at the end. Okay, give me 10 more minutes and I'll come to that. Yeah?
Two questions. One is that value of A zero, it's been experimental and measured for different galaxies, so it really is some tangible number that comes from the actual measurement.
Yes.
Okay. And the other question is, did anyone ever consider a possibility that some combination of those two hypotheses might be true?
Sure. Yes. Now if I can figure out how to do it, I'm gonna show some data. Okay. I promised you some data. Okay, but does everybody understand Mr. Milgram's new theory, or new theory as of 1982?
Just the acceleration gets too small, and Newton's physics break down, and you need something new.
Right. Okay.
Does he have a system? So his A
naught value is that value they found to that graph. Yes. Okay. I took a risk not setting this up beforehand, but I knew I wanted. There we are. Okay. Now where's my pointer? Okay. Now. Thank you. This is real data. This is a galaxy called NGC 1560, which means it's in the New Galactic Catalog, new a very long time ago, and it's the 1560th galaxy in the catalog. I don't know anything else about it. Here is the rotational velocity. Here is the radius. The rotational velocity is in kilometers per second, 0, 50, etc., to give you an idea of the scales. Here's the radius. It's in a unit called KPC, which means kiloparsec. A parsec is about 3 light years, and a kilo means thousands. So these are in units of 3,000 light years. So 6,000 light years, etc. Okay? Now, here is the distribution measured of stars and gas. Here, with error bars, of course, but notice they get very small as you go out, are the measurements of the velocities. And here, the red curve is the theory I just told you about. Okay?
The green line is...
The green line is the measurement of the density that goes into predicting, because all of this theory uses just visible matter. Okay, so you measure some visible matter and you predict using this theory what the velocity should be.
But is that the red line, is that the predicted or actual?
Red line is the predicted. The actual are the blue, are observations. I'll just keep hitting it. We're not going to stay so long on one piece of data. So does everybody understand the data? Okay. Well, that's one galaxy, right? There's another galaxy called F563-1. Okay? Again, the same things. the measured density of gas, the measured density of stars, the prediction, and the data is with the error bars. So this dumb theory, which doesn't make any sense, and I'll, in the last few minutes that I have, I will convince you that the theory doesn't make any sense. This, I told you I would give you a real puzzle. Okay? So maybe they just got lucky. Well, there's a bunch more galaxies.
They all were. So why does it not make sense?
Okay? The red is the theoretical prediction, the blue is the measurement of matter, and the blue error bars are the data of the measurements of the velocity. Okay? Many different galaxies. Notice there's a huge variety of galaxies, of distributions of matter. There are very different distributions of matter. That one goes just goes down. This one comes up and goes down sharply. Okay? And every case that's shown here, it does well. Yeah?
So if experiments show that its predicting power is so accurate, does that mean nowadays people still accept its predicting power but try to find a reason behind it, or do they still not accept it?
Different people believe different things. The most important thing to understand about science is there are two kinds of questions in science. Those that everybody agrees on, because we're forced to by the evidence, whether the evidence is data or theory, and those that we're not forced to agree about by evidence, in which case we disagree with each other. So you can find astronomers, professional astronomers, and physicists who have any point of view you like on this, from this is completely ridiculous to this is the most important thing going on in science. Okay. So as of a year or so ago when I made this table, there were 84 galaxies that did well when fitted with theory. There were a bunch of galaxies, about 20, that didn't, but if you looked in the papers, there was some excuse for why that galaxy didn't work, because the data wasn't good or there was some misestimates. And there were no galaxies that could not be either fit by the theory or explained away. Okay?
Is the Milky Way fit?
Hold on. I want to show you one more thing. Yeah. This is this Tully-Fisher law. This is the log of the luminosity. This is the log of the velocity. This is the relationship that the fourth power of the velocity goes like the luminosity. Scientists like to graph logs of things so that powers become straight lines. And that straight line has a slope of 3.9 plus or minus 0.2. So it agrees with the 4, which is what many people take. Okay? And everything else on this slide is actually stuff that I've been telling you. Okay? Now, that's what we know. Let me summarize, and then there were various questions I'll take. I can leave that there for a minute. So, this theory of Milgram was proposed in 1982. I explained why. So far, it does well for many galaxies. But it has some issues. So I want to explain to you how complicated it is. First of all, somebody asked about outside of galaxies. Okay. And this simple law does not work very well, apparently, to explain how clusters of galaxies hold together. It doesn't work very well. And there would be a big difference, because as you go really far out from a galaxy to the force felt by two galaxies acting on each other, the difference between 1 over r and 1 over r squared is huge. So it would have a huge effect on the dynamics of galaxies if it were still true. So it doesn't seem like there's a 1 over r force happening far away from galaxies, measured by looking at other galaxies. Also, this theory
makes no sense, and let me explain to you why it makes no sense. Okay? You have probably, you learned, you know, in studying about electricity and magnetism, about field lines, and there are also gravitational field lines, and there's a law that says that when you go away from a source, and this is true of Newton's gravitational theory, and it's true of electricity and magnetism, okay, that, let me just talk about electricity and Newton's theory, that as you go away, the total flux of the electric field or the gravitational field through a surface is the same. The flux is the strength of the force times the area of the surface. What? Yes, yes. And because of that, if you believe that forces are due to something like field lines, then the forces have to decrease like 1 over the distance squared so that the flux through a sphere remains the same as the area of the sphere grows like the distance squared. So the idea of conservation of flux, okay, requires that the forces decrease like 1 over distance squared. A force that decreases slower than that, like 1 over distance, is as if there are flux lines created from nowhere. Okay? That doesn't make sense. It's also very hard to make sense of this in the context of relativity theory, either special relativity or general relativity, although you mentioned that there recently there are attempts to do so. They're far from proof. Okay. But there are three people. One of them is John Moffat. Another one who is actually a colleague here. He works here in this building. Another one is Jacob Bekenstein, who is one of the great living physicists, who's the person who discovered or invented the idea that black holes have entropy. Okay. And there's another one that I'm forgetting the name of the person. There are three different attempts to extend this to make it consistent with general relativity. Okay? My own view is that they're in progress. People are seeing maybe they can make sense of things at larger scales. Maybe they make sense. I'm very unconvinced. That's my view. But I'm glad that they're exploring the idea. Now, what about hypothesis one, that there's unseen matter? Hypothesis one does very well explaining everything except curves like that. Hypothesis one does not do very well, that is, models of dark matter that astronomers make do not do very well predicting these actual curves. But they do the following things. First of all, you can use an effect called gravitational lensing to measure matter a third way. And how do you do that? So general relativity, Einstein's theory of general relativity, says that when light passes near a star or a distribution of matter, it's bent. And it means that basically matter curves space so that space acts like a lens. And you can actually, if you look at some distant galaxies, looking at the light through a distribution of matter, like a galaxy or clusters of galaxies, you can see the light stretch. You can see the kind of aberrations that come from passing through a lens. And by using that, you can use general relativity to measure the distribution of matter a third way. And this has been recently done by many people. Margaret Geller is on the forefront of this, astronomer at Harvard, Smithsonian Observatory. And those observations coming in the last 3 years or so are bang on dark matter. That is, the matter, the distribution of matter as predicted by Einstein's theory using gravitational lensing predicts that there is extra matter, and predicts the extra matter is where the dark matter theories say the extra matter should be. So that's a point for dark matter, for hypothesis one. Another point for hypothesis one is the following. Okay.
there is a whole study of how structure forms in the universe as it expands. And using the cosmic microwave background radiation, people can measure the density and the distribution of visible matter about a million years after the Big Bang. This is what's measured by the WMAP and the COBE satellites. And if you measure the distribution of matter as it was then, and if you assume that all the matter was visible matter, and you use Newton's laws or general relativity to predict in the future how the galaxies will form, they never form. That is, there isn't enough force, there isn't enough clustering of matter then to cause galaxies ever to form. So to believe the galaxies formed since the Big Bang, you have to believe, and it's the same story, either in extra matter, which is dark, whose distribution you don't see through those experiments, or you have to believe in new laws, like some relativistic version of mind. Okay. And when it comes to explaining how structure forms, the dark matter theory, which is older, does really well. Not perfectly well, because it doesn't explain these observations, but it does pretty well. And the other theory has only the last year or two are people trying to use it to explain structure formation. So it's too soon to tell. Okay. So let me summarize, and then I'll take some more questions. The situation is there's definitely something wrong, and I hope everybody got that. Okay. There's definitely, definitely Newton's laws plus the hypothesis that the matter is the visible matter is false. Those two things together are false, period. Every observation shows they're false. There are then two hypotheses, that is extra dark matter, or that Newton's law is wrong, and there's even a particular hypothesis due to Mr. Milgram about how Newton's law is modified. So there are two, this is you know, the kind of thing that science makes science fun and exciting. There are two different hypotheses. They're really different. One of them says we know the laws, but we don't know what the matter is. The other one says we know what the matter is, but the laws on large scales are completely different from what we think they are. Okay? Both of them have successes, and both of them have failures. It's not, science is not simple. It's not that you have a hypothesis, you do an experiment, you check it, okay, that was a day's work. Okay? Okay. Here's a situation where you can find evidence, strong evidence for either hypothesis. And you can find strong problems with believing either hypothesis. Okay. And this is real science. To resolve it, either somebody maybe someday will really detect dark matter, or maybe somebody will detect some modification of Newton's law. And I see the time is running out, so maybe I'll just take some questions. I don't want to skip. I don't want you to skip lunch. I just had lunch. So questions?
I was reading Thoreau's Quantum Gravity, and you said in it that cosmic rays, they're 10 times stronger than the strongest particle accelerator. Do you know if there's any...
Many times stronger. I didn't say 10 times, but...
Oh, okay. Lots. Anyways, do you know of any experiments or any plans on using that energy to make a particle accelerator in space?
Well, there are... So this is a little bit off the topic, but there are particle accelerators in space. There are cosmic rays that that accelerate particles, probably protons, up to scales of, let me see what the right units are, at least a million times the largest energy of the largest conceivable accelerator we could build on Earth. So there are those, and there are detectors of them, and they are very interesting and important experiments. But that's, why don't you ask me about that later, because that's, as far as I know, that doesn't check these hypotheses.
Okay.
Yeah?
Would Milgram's theory also apply if the acceleration was very low because the mass was small?
Yes.
So you'd see those sort of effects if it was just things like the gravity or the gravitational pull of the table or something?
If you could measure it, yes. Yes.
Yeah, so since these are like this is basically saying one acceleration very small in terms of the applied, can we just do experiments to verify this? Like we just do experiments on simple particles and stuff, so that the acceleration is so small, so that we can it's below this value and we can actually verify if this was correct.
Can you suggest such an experiment?
Well, as long as we can have an acceleration that's small enough, then I think it should be pretty easy to verify, right?
Really hard, but please, maybe you will. Maybe you will.
So is it because we can't reach that kind of small acceleration?
I'll tell you about one more experiment. Do I have a minute?
Sure.
Okay. This one. One way to do an experiment is to send satellites outside the solar system and track them over decades. And this experiment has been done several times. The way you do this experiment, this was not intended, this is an accidental experiment. So there are two satellites called Pioneer satellites that were sent in the 70s out on a tour of the outer planets, and then they just kept going. And they're dead now, I believe they're dead, but until sometime in the 1990s, they were sending radio signals back. And from those radio signals, there's a Doppler shift. And from that Doppler shift, you can measure their velocity. Now, since we know all about all the matter in the solar system, you can predict the velocity they should have by using Newton's laws. Okay? And when this was done for the Pioneers, let's see, this is Pioneer 10, after you took out the velocity they should have from Newton's laws, you were left with an error. They were left, these are scientists at Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. They're left with an error that increased linearly with time. That is, and what does that mean if there's a velocity difference which is increasing linearly with time?
Constant acceleration.
That's a constant acceleration. So there is a constant acceleration, as it turns out, towards the sun, felt by the Pioneer 10 satellite over the years from 1986 to 1994.
It's coming back?
There's a small acceleration towards the sun. It's not coming back, but it has less velocity than it should by a velocity deficit, which is growing linearly in time. So there's a small acceleration. It's also true in Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11. So here's measurements of that acceleration. Here's the distance from the sun from 10 astronomical units. An astronomical unit is the orbit of the Earth, out to about 50 astronomical units. I think they went out to about 70 before they stopped broadcasting. And here's the measurement of the extra acceleration, which does seem to be constant. And it has a value. And that value, which is called the Pioneer acceleration, a Pioneer, is 8.6 times 10 to minus 8 centimeters per second squared. Okay, which is the same order of magnitude as the Mond acceleration. Okay? Now, this is mysterious. This was noticed about, I don't know, 5-8 years ago, something like that, when the Jet Propulsion Laboratory were going through their data. It's true for both of those satellites. There's also data for Ulysses crafts, which have gone out of the solar system in different directions, which is much less good quality, so it's not shown usually. But if you squint, it has the same feature in it of an extra acceleration. So this is just a possible piece of evidence that there's even a problem with Newton's laws near the solar system. This is much less believed. It's much better that it's two satellites rather than one, and they're going out of the solar system in different directions. But it's only two satellites, and it's the same laboratory
that set them up to built and so forth. So anyway, so this is another thing that keeps people up at night. So relative to what you suggest. And what people are suggesting now is building a satellite just for the purposes of measuring this effect, that is testing really accurately do Newton's laws work in the solar system. And this is being talked about by the European Space Agency for launch in the next few years. Okay. So if what I told you today will keep you up at night, keeps me up at night sometimes, this keeps people up at night. It could easily, and let me emphasize, because the message of what I'm trying to tell you is that science is fun, it's challenging, but it's not simple. Okay? You could spend years worrying about this, and then it could turn out to be a computer error in the software that analyzes the data. It's probably not, because you can believe that these people work over their code over and over and over again before they publish. Okay? But it could always be a problem in the data. Okay. Or it could be that they don't understand the design of their own spacecraft. And there's a slow gas leak out the back side.
There should be the exhaust gas, right?
Well, the things are practically dead at this point. I mean, these are things that are functioning from a little bit of solar array. There's nothing in these things. By the time that they're way out there, there's nothing in them. Okay. But a big solar array, a battery, and a radio transmitter going boop, 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 and the experiment was over. Okay? This is just residual data from the transponder because they tried to keep track of it as long as they could. And they're still out there somewhere. No, they would be hard to find to put a pile of it. Okay, I'll take another last question or two.
Is there like hypothesis number 3?
The pioneer is too weird. The hypothesis for the pioneer is that these very smart, dedicated people made a mistake somewhere. Is there a hypothesis 3?
For the other
problem. Why did
you?
Oh, for sure. I mean. No, these are the two prominent hypotheses. These are the two prominent hypotheses. But there's lots of people who have an equation which is different from Milgram's because they think a slightly different equation matches the data better. Okay, there's a lot of stuff like that. Okay.
Is there any way to combine the two, hypothesis 1 and hypothesis 2?
Sure.
Sure.
It might be that Mon works on the scalar of galaxies, but when you get out beyond the galaxy, it doesn't work anymore. It goes back to some Newtonian thing. And meanwhile, the clusters of galaxies and the structure formation is made by massive neutrinos, which are kind of dark. It turns out that there are kinds of dark matter that would hold clusters of galaxies together, but would not account for actually the rotation curves of galaxies, which are massive neutrinos. So it could be that there are massive neutrinos plus Mon.
Sure.
Which, of course, makes it much harder to design a crucial experiment. I mean, and let me emphasize, when I told the story of Vera Rubin, I did it not just because I think she's cool, but because she did two crucial experiments, especially the second one that got all the data on one photographic plate. Okay, if you remember when I explained that to you. What's important about that experiment is it was not possible to question it. If they had taken individual measurements of the redshifts of the stars in galaxies, they could have said there's calibration errors, the electronics are drifting, the current is going up and down, et cetera. One image on one photographic plate captured the whole curve of the velocities. And it's impossible to screw that up once you got it to work. Okay.
Right.
So, oh, sure, I could screw it. But the point is that the genius that goes into inventing experiments that cannot be disagreed with is something really to admire. There's a lot of ingenuity and imagination that goes into the invention of experiments, and that's one of the really great ones. Okay, I'll take the last question then. Yes. The dark matter hypothesis, until recently, was much more widely supported. And the data that I was showing you for MOND only became available in the last 2 years. And the opinion about MOND has gone from, are you kidding? Laughing, as you talk to very, very good astronomers, very, you know, people who have had a lot of successes, I've noticed, over, I'm not an astronomer, but I've noticed when I've asked them about this over the last 5 years, an evolution from, are you kidding, that's a joke, to, my God, the data really works, we don't understand why. Okay. But the dominant point of view for many, many years, the simplest explanation and the most believed explanation for many years has been the dark matter, which is why many experiments have been built to look for dark matter. Okay. I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Answer any questions. Before we go to lunch, if anyone has